From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And coming up, some changes on your grocery store shelves. Food giants Heinz and Kraft agree to a merger.
But first, let's go to Indiana, where the Republican Governor Mike Pence is poised to sign a controversial bill into law that would protect the religious freedom of business owners, although opponents say the bill would allow those business owners to discriminate against gays and lesbians. Organizers of Gen Con, a big gaming convention held every year in Indianapolis, are threatening this week to leave the state in the future over the bill. Indiana would become the 20th state with a religious freedom law. Joining us from Indianapolis is Kevin Briniger, president and CEO of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. And Kevin, you oppose the bill. Why?
Well, two reasons. One, we think that the bill overall is unnecessary. But also, in particular, the bill as it was introduced and as it passed the Senate included a new right of legal action against employers by employees and prospective employees, and we were very opposed, and the business community as a whole was very opposed to the notion of having new reasons for litigation against employers.
Explain that. What exactly would that allow people to do?
Well, it would allow if you had a situation where you owned a restaurant and you had someone of a particular religious faith come in and want to be served, and you had a server who refused because of religious beliefs to serve that particular individual, and the employer says, well, I've got to have servers who will serve anybody and everyone who comes through the door, and the employer terminates that employee. The way the bill was originally written, that employee could then turn around and sue the employer and say, you were making me do something that's against my religious beliefs, and it puts employers in the untenable situation of trying to distinguish between what are legitimate, bona fide religious beliefs and activities that aren't.
What about the broader concern, though, that this would discriminate against gays and lesbians from going into restaurants, and they might be turned away because somebody claims they have a religious belief that doesn't allow them to serve a gay person or a lesbian?
Well, that was certainly the arguments brought forth in the committee testimony in both the House and the Senate by various opponent groups. And I think at the end of the day that this will, in our state at least, prove to be much ado about nothing, because businesses are in business to provide goods and services to customers, and they can only do that if they provide those goods and services, and they're not generally in the business of turning customers away. And so I think in reality, this is likely to have little or no impact. This follows federal legislation that was passed in 1993, and now 19 other states have enacted this legislation. And while we oppose the introduced version, and we even now believe that the legislation is unnecessary, I think 5 years from now, this will by and large be forgotten.
But in the state of Arizona, where similar legislation was introduced, we remember that Governor Jan Brewer, Republican governor, former governor of Arizona, vetoed that bill because of pressure from companies including Apple and American Airlines.
That's true, and I'm sure different states will handle this differently. I will be surprised if our governor does not sign this legislation.
But was there pressure from businesses in Indiana who were saying this is going to harm the reputation of this state in the business community?
Absolutely. And those businesses are speaking out even today as we wait to see for certain what the governor is going to do with this legislation that has now passed both the Indiana House and Senate. And there are many in the business community that object. There were others that supported the legislation as a way to guarantee their religious freedoms.
If this bill is unnecessary, as you say, why do you think it got such support in the legislature in Indiana? I see, 40 in favor and only 10 against?
Well, that was a partisan split. It follows a vigorous debate last year over a proposed constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriages that ultimately got overridden by a decision by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. But really, by and large, you had the same groups on both sides of this issue that you had on the marriage amendment last year.
What have the businesses that you represent who support this bill been saying to you about why you need something like this?
We haven't had many that frankly that support this bill that we've had conversations with, but you know, it kind of goes back to the the original federal legislation, and they want something at the state level that mirrors that. There's been a lot of references to the Hobby Lobby case where, you know, that privately owned company objected to some of the things that were imposed on them by Obamacare. And, you know, these privately held companies want the ability to protect their religious freedoms in terms of who they may or may not have to provide service to.
That's Kevin Briniger, the president and CEO of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, talking with us about a bill that is on the governor's desk at this point that's aimed at protecting the religious freedom of business owners. But opponents say it would allow those business owners to discriminate, particularly against gays and lesbians. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Oh, my pleasure to visit with you and your listeners.
Well, now some big news from the supermarket aisle and probably at least a day of food jokes. They go together like ketchup and Oscar Mayer wieners or Velveeta cheese and Ora Ida potatoes. Food giants Heinz and Kraft have agreed to merge, bringing brands like Kool-Aid, Velveeta, Heinz ketchup under one umbrella. Heinz chair Alex Behring put the merger in context this morning on a conference call with investors.
Combining our two businesses will create the third largest food and beverage company in North America, and the fifth largest food and beverage company in the world.
And that company will be called Kraft Heinz. CNN's Maggie Lake joins us now. And Maggie, obviously, it's a big deal. I mean, the combined company could be worth $100 billion by 2017, we're reading. But why else is this a big deal? You know, what's behind the merger?
You know, Robin, this is one of those motivated by bigger is better. It seems like both of these are big, giant food brands, but they've been struggling a little bit lately as consumers kind of move away from that processed food, things that are viewed as maybe a little unhealthy, toward more fresh, local, organic. We've talked about that in the past. This seems to be an attempt to sort of combine forces, lever up that global supply chain, get costs down, and I think importantly, really focus on international markets where there's a growing middle class. Heinz is better known there. Kraft has really struggled. So it looks like they're hoping to kind of prop each other up and bulk up as they both struggle to kind of find a way forward.
Well, let's remind people, Kraft owns so many iconic brands, Oscar Mayer, Jell-O, Kool-Aid, Velveeta, and of course, Kraft macaroni and cheese. People might remember this ad from 1981.
Make some Kraft macaroni and cheese, please.
Please make some Kraft macaroni and cheese. It's nice and cheesy and it's really pretty easy.
Okay.
Please.
Okay, but Maggie, that's Kraft macaroni and cheese. Kraft Heinz macaroni and cheese does not quite roll off the tongue in the same way. Is there a risk that making this big change will jeopardize these iconic companies?
Yeah, this does remind a lot of people of their childhood, doesn't it? But I got to tell you, it's probably not familiar to my kids. And I think that they don't have much to lose because it doesn't have much traction. There's so much attention on the risks of sodium, high fructose, sugar, that a lot of parents are turning away from those choices for their children. The brands are just not out there as much. So I don't think they're worried as much about the past. I think they're trying to define the future and maybe reach people that aren't as turned off. You know, again, back to those international markets, they're a growing middle class. Some of them haven't been exposed to the brands, and they may have a little bit more appetite than some of the sort of, you know, certainly the U.S. market where there is a lot more awareness and a shift away. So I think they're certainly willing to take that risk, Robin.
Yeah, a lot of families are turning to companies like Annie's for their macaroni and cheese.
Yes, exactly.
We remember, too, Kraft had to recall more than 6 million boxes over concerns that some might contain pieces of metal. Nobody was injured. There was also a controversy over whether Kraft Singles, which are called prepared cheese products, would get a Kids Eat Right health food label. So obviously, you know, the merch company might address some of that. But who's involved? We know it's a company called 3G Capital and billionaire Warren Buffett. What does that mean to you?
And I think the Warren Buffett thing is what has a lot of people excited. I'm not sure consumers themselves care so much about this, but investors loved this deal today, especially Kraft investors. That stock was up a lot. Buffett really has a stamp of approval, doesn't he, when he puts his hand in something. And he loves food companies. He is already – Berkshire has stakes in Dairy Queen, See's, Mars, Coca-Cola famously. In fact, Buffett himself said he likes to eat like a six-year-old. You often see him walking around in Omaha with these brands. He likes businesses. He understands understands. He likes brands that are popular with the middle class, even if they're considered a little boring. The other player in this is 3G. He's teamed up with them. They're a private equity. They've been very active in buying up food companies. Seems like they also like brands that cater to the middle class. And interestingly, they're known for cost cutting. Again, that a driving issue here. Looks like they're going to try to really those horrible mergers like Synergy, but get that global supply chain sort of slimmed down and working for both companies instead of replicating. And also, they're based in Brazil. So again, it's that return to that focus on the emerging markets, that growing middle class elsewhere in the world as a way to maybe find a growth path forward. So yeah. Those two teaming up, they have in the past, they may again, but they're clearly really interested in the food area.
Well, when you say they have in the past, they teamed up to buy Heinz for $23 billion before, mm-hmm. Now adding Kraft. CNN's Maggie Lake, thank you so much. Yesterday, President Obama announced he would leave 9,000 American troops in Afghanistan through the end of the year. But millions of veterans who served in both Afghanistan and Iraq have come home, and many are facing a tough transition, finding a new job or starting a new career. Congress is trying to help, sending veterans to the farm. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, here's Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell.
Sarah Creech has a master's degree in nursing and 16 years of experience in the field, including a stint as an Air Force surgery nurse during the Iraq War. Like one in five veterans of that war, Creech came home with PTSD. She said when she tried to return to nursing in the private sector, her depression and anxiety became so severe she felt like she was dangerous to her patients.
My sister one day was like, "What are you going to do with your life?" And I told her I had no idea. I said, "I just want to buy a farm and move out to the middle of nowhere and just get away from everything."
Creech got her wish, thanks to the 2014 Farm Bill. The legislation names veterans as a distinct class of beginning farmer within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That means veterans are eligible for low-interest rate loans to buy animals and equipment, they can apply for grants to build onto their farm, and they can receive extra payments to implement conservation practices on their land. Veterans also get priority preference when it comes to the USDA's support for beginning farmers, ahead of non-veterans and minority farmers.
More than anything, it's just an acknowledgement.
Michael O'Gorman is the founder of the Farmer Veteran Coalition, a nonprofit organization that helps veterans start careers in agriculture. O'Gorman says the legislation is compensation for the time veterans took away from their own goals to serve.
You know, the veterans don't want a handout, but it'd be nice to go to the front of a few lines, because even if one did come home unharmed, many of them didn't, they still took years out of a normal development of a career.
The Farm Bill also sets aside close to $1 million for programs that train veterans to become farmers. It's a tiny part of the $500 billion bill, but it's meant as a first step.
It's an absolute natural fit.
Karis Gutter is the USDA's first military veterans agriculture liaison. The legislation created his position to connect veterans and the nonprofits serving them with the USDA's resources. The USDA hopes these programs are a wise investment. About 2.5 million veterans have returned home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and nearly half of them come from rural counties. A department report from 2013 showed that they have more education and technical training than their non-veteran peers. Gutter says they also bring unique skills from their military experience.
Many of our men and women who've served the country come from rural America and get training to work with their hands and have a natural instinct for entrepreneurship.
Sarah Creech is proof. 3 years ago, she quit her job as a nurse and used her savings account and support from her family to buy a foreclosed farmhouse on 43 acres of land in rural Indiana.
A lot of people call chickens the gateway animal.
She started out planting an orchard of fruit trees, apples, peaches, cherries, and pears. She added berry bushes and vegetables. And then she bought her first chickens.
Once you have a chicken on a farm, then you end up getting sheep on the farm, and then you end up getting horses, and it just explodes from there.
This year, Creech's Blue Yonder Organic Farm received $21,000 from the USDA because of her veteran status. She's using the money to improve the quality of her soil and build a hoop house, which hopefully will lengthen her growing season and increase her profits. But that's not her priority. In many ways, she says the work pays for itself.
I am getting out of bed every day, and I am doing my chores every day, and I'm taking care of animals every day. Like, people are relying on me. I don't know where my life is going to take me, but I feel like I'm on the right path.
And Creech says she wants to help other vets find their path, too. She hosts veterans groups at Blue Yonder for week-long workshops to give them a taste of life on the farm. For Here and Now, I'm Abby Wendell.
All right, well, now turning to Africa. Any guesses? That is an elephant. It sounds from the Elephant Listening Projects. And elephant advocates are meeting today in Botswana to crack down on the multi-billion dollar poaching trade. Joining us now to talk about that is Vicky Croak, who covers animal issues for us at Here and Now. And Vicky, tell us more about this conference.
Well, delegates from more than 30 countries are in Botswana right now. They're meeting today discussing the best ways to fight poaching and wildlife trafficking, so much of it concerning ivory and its flow from Africa to China. The thrust of the summit is that wildlife trafficking is organized by sophisticated international criminal networks. It's a $19 billion a year business, and it's going to take cooperation among many countries just to slow it down.
So what kind of solutions are likely to come up?
A lot of what's being discussed is policy development at the government level. So action plans for setting up legal frameworks and deterrence and beefing up law enforcement, that sort of thing. And there's been some tough talk. Will Travers from the Born Free Foundation has been tweeting from inside the summit. And one of his tweets was a quote from someone at Botswana's Ministry of Environment. Travers quotes the person as saying, "God will judge the poachers. It's up to us to arrange the meeting."
Hmm.
In previous summits, delegates signed on to action plans. And this time around, participants are expected to present progress reports. Just one example, though, of what governments can do was demonstrated in Ethiopia this month.
Where they actually burned ivory.
That's right. They burned their entire stockpile of ivory, 6 tons. That's whole tusks as well as carved items. Conservation groups tell us that destroying all ivory makes it impossible to launder illegal ivory. And it's estimated that 20,000 elephants are killed every year for their ivory. And in one span over 2010, 11, and 12, something like 100,000 elephants were slaughtered. Every country that destroys its confiscated ivory not only prevents that ivory from going into the trade, but it helps spread the message that living elephants are worth more than their tusks.
Which is a message that you have helped spread. You've written a whole book about elephants.
That's right. And you know something, I mean, they're high in my mind and as well as many other people. And one of my heroes is in Africa. Her name's Daphne Sheldrick, and a lot of people know her. She runs this wonderful, famous elephant orphanage in Kenya. Because of this huge change in slaughtering elephants over the last decades, her operation has grown into a large-scale mission of mercy with dedicated teams of caretakers, veterinarians, anti-poaching squads, and they even have their own little tiny air force. And so right now, she's got 34 baby elephants in her care at the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. The latest Sheldrick elephant baby is a little 14-month-old named Ala Maya, who was not only orphaned but attacked by hyenas in the night before helpers could get to her. So she was airlifted to safety just last week and cared for by people who've perfected the complicated methods of saving the babies. They may be big. I mean, they're born at 250 pounds, but they're extremely sensitive emotionally. They're just like people, Sheldrick often says. And Ala Maya, she had her tail bitten off, probably by those hyenas, but she's in really good hands now. And you can see pictures of her wearing her warm red plaid blanket on our site.
The challenges that these animals face, even in addition to poachers, which is a big problem still.
That's right. There's habitat loss, and then they face the threats that they've always had in the wild, other animals.
Well, let's talk about some other animals that you wanted us to hear about, some stories that are in the news right now, one of which is that dogs had a role in the downfall of Neanderthals. Explain.
So we have a new book out by an anthropologist named Pat Shipman. It's called Invaders, How Humans and Their Dogs Drove Neanderthals to Extinction, which kind of tells you the story. So Shipman makes this case that early dogs were critical to modern humans, our line, beating out Neanderthals in the game of life. So we have new archaeological evidence and DNA analysis that are pushing back the clock for when we started associating with wolves or wolf dogs.
Hmm.
And that time frame now overlaps some of the time in which modern humans spread into Europe and Neanderthals declined quickly.
And why is that significant?
Well, so how and why Neanderthals vanished has been a big mystery for a long time. And Shipman, and what she has to say, we think that modern humans outcompeted the Neanderthals because we had that secret weapon. And it was dogs who helped us hunt and who protected us in our campsites.
We liked dogs and they didn't.
Yeah, that's in it in a nutshell, Jeremy. And what's funny about all of this is that there was some intermingling between modern humans and Neanderthals. So today, all people from outside Africa have anywhere from 1 to 4% of Neanderthal DNA in our systems. And that has led some, like the author, Lauren Slater, I think this is really funny, she jokingly wonders if people who love dogs have the lower amount of Neanderthal DNA and those who dislike dogs have the higher ratio. But as far as I know, no yeah, scientist.
I don't know. I mean, I love dogs, but... who knows how related I am to a Neanderthal?
Yeah, there's no shame. There's no shame in being a Neanderthal.
Well, finally, Vicky, some news about manatees, some good news about manatees.
That's right. We have great news coming out of Florida. They just finished the census for the manatee population, and it's a record number, 6,063. That's up 1,000 from the previous record in 2010. And this is according to the State Wildlife Commission. The increase is due to a couple of things. One is that we've made their world a little bit safer, but also they had super good weather conditions during the count. So they probably didn't miss as many manatees when they were counting them up. But there's the fear that some groups of people are going to be fighting to take away the manatees' endangered status, which would strip protections from them, like the slow speed zones for boats that are set up now. And conservationists really want to preserve a lot of those protections. It's pretty hard to dislike a manatee, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, they're like a fat dolphin, basically. How could you dislike that?
That's right. I call them lovable lumps, which is a more technical term for it. But they're so gentle and slow moving. And they're the aquatic version of an elephant, really. Peaceniks, they eat seagrasses and freshwater vegetation. But anyway, they can also live to be up the age of 60. And that's if we give them the chance to do that.
Vicky Croke, who covers all things animal for us at Here and Now, and you can see pictures and videos of the animals we've been talking about at our website, hereandnow.org. Vicky, thank you for the updates.
Thank you, Jeremy.
A report out today from the Department of Homeland Security says the number of international students being accepted into U.S. universities is at an unprecedented high. There are more than 1 million foreign students studying here in the U.S., with the number of those accepted from overseas up 14% in the last year, up 50% since 2010. Kevin McLennan is Director of Admissions for the University of Colorado Boulder, and he's with us now to discuss. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you.
And when you look at the top five for international students on this list, we've got the University of Southern California at number one. Number two is Purdue. Number three is Columbia. Number four, the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and New York University comes in at number five. How are you doing at CU Boulder on this front, getting international students to come and study there?
I think one of the things that I oftentimes point out is we're a little bit later to the game. Our recruitment plans for international students only began about 4 to 5 years ago, but we're sitting at about 7% of our undergraduate population is international, with probably a goal of about 10% overall.
And why do you have that goal? Is this just about bringing in students who will pay full freight and offset some of the costs for people who are especially in-state students in Colorado?
One of the reasons to internationalize is it's very important to be a world-class university, to have a global education for all students. And the benefit the international students bring to our campus increases the academic quality for all students and our domestic students, because we have domestic students that learn from international students that learn from our domestic students. So that's certainly a big part of what we're doing. And also it's part of our non-resident recruitment strategy as well.
Fair enough. But what about the financial side of it? Does it help to have more international students?
It absolutely does. And I think campuses across the country have realized that because international students typically pay non-resident rates or slightly higher than that, that there is additional revenue that's coming in to help at universities across our country. So that, yes, that's certainly a part of it.
And I noticed that the top three foreign countries for undergraduates who are coming to CU Boulder, they're coming from China, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. How do you go after those students?
We have a division within the admissions office that specializes in international student recruitment. And as an example, we traveled in 40 countries around the world in the fall, and this spring we're traveling in about 29 countries around the world. So we're really diversifying our international market by traveling all across the globe to many countries in addition to the ones that you listed.
Kevin, is there a worry that by bringing in more international students, you are basically taking away slots from students who live in Colorado and want to go to CU Boulder?
as a flagship institution in our state, we're here first for Colorado citizens, and we're admitting between 85 and 90% of all the Colorado residents that apply to the University of Colorado Boulder, and we haven't had to turn away Colorado students that we think can be successful at the university. So our mission to begin the year is always to have a majority of Colorado residents, and we've saved those spaces for those students and have been successful admitting at the rate I just mentioned.
That's Kevin McLennan, the Director of Admissions for the University of Colorado Boulder, and you can see more about this report about international students at American universities at our website, hereandnow.org. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. I appreciate it.
And now I'd like you to meet my dear friend and mentor, 88-year-old Seymour Bernstein. Oh, wait. I've never met Seymour Bernstein, but I feel as if I have, and I don't want him to leave. Seymour was an acclaimed concert pianist when he up and quit at the age of 50 to write, compose, and teach. Now he's the subject of a new documentary, and here he demonstrates the need for players to have a palette of emotions by playing Beethoven.
Do you know how many men try to subdue the feminine in them? Well, look, here's Beethoven. I mean, that's a man doing this, right?
Lucky for those of us not good enough to take lessons with Seymour Bernstein, actor Ethan Hawke sat next to him at a dinner party, and the result is the new documentary, Seymour, An Introduction. And Seymour Bernstein joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And your thoughts when an actor says to you, I want to make a movie about you?
My first reaction was, now, why would anyone want to make a documentary on the likes of me? But I did find out eventually. You see, I wrote a book called With Your Own Two Hands.
Yeah.
And the thesis of that book is that a serious involvement in practicing and performing can make us not only better musicians, but more importantly, better people. And that became the thesis of the documentary.
That when all is well with your art, all is well with your life.
It goes in that direction. If you're an actor or if you're a musician, you have to integrate and synthesize your emotional, intellectual, and physical worlds. That's a very powerful attainment.
Yeah.
So when you attain it in your art, the idea is to direct it into every aspect of your life. And that really interested Ethan.
Yeah. Well, let's see what else Ethan was so taken with. We learn your life story. No music in your home growing up. You just knew you had to have a piano. And once when you were very young, your mother came very late at night, it sounds like, to find you crying over, was it Schubert?
Yes, you see, I was 6 years old. And I discovered Schubert's Serenade. As soon as I started to play it, it felt as though I had always known that piece. And I started to cry. Well, my mother was alarmed. She said, why are you crying? I said, it's the most beautiful piece I ever heard. And there it is. You're playing it for me.
Well, it's Horowitz playing it for you. It's so beautiful. And you knew that as a child, you were so struck with that beauty.
Can't account for it.
Yeah.
I mean, how could I ever think that I knew that piece? I didn't know anything about music at all.
Why did you quit?
You see, my initial ambition was to play my best in major concert halls, in spite of my nervousness. Well, it took me 50 years, and then finally I felt good on the stage. When I reached that pinnacle, I gave myself a present, and I arranged a farewell concert, and I brought my performing career to an end, And I have been happy ever since.
Well, interesting. Michael Kimmelman, one of your former students now, the architect critic for The New York Times, interviews you in the new documentary. He seems genuinely upset about the fact that you quit performing. He asked you, don't you feel a responsibility to perform given the incredible gift that you have? You had a great answer.
I did. I said, Michael, I poured it into you.
As a teacher. And I was thinking, but he's still performing. Teachers perform.
Yep. After all, when you're teaching, you can't only talk about music. You have to demonstrate it.
We see you teaching at home in your small studio apartment. You sleep on a fold-out couch. You're devoted to these students. We see you in a master class. You tell one player, don't play the keys all the way to the key bed. Another's leaning away from the piano, and you say that's taking the energy out of the notes. You gently push him towards the keys to keep the energy in the notes. What is the one thing, perhaps the primary thing, you want to communicate to pianists?
Well, the major thing is to become one with the music. And if you don't make the proper physical connection to what it is that you're feeling and thinking, then you can't project the music and the instrument doesn't respond.
Well, you talk about other famous musicians, Glenn Gould, the famously technically perfect performer, the interpreter of Bach. You're not as impressed with his work, but Sir Clifford Curzon, the British pianist. Let's listen to a little of him playing. You talk about how he was so compelling to you that you wrote a letter asking if you could study with him. You went to Britain and did. Then you wrote a letter to the Queen later and asked why he wasn't knighted, why he didn't have a title. He got a title. Perhaps you had something to do with it. But as we're watching him play, it brings tears. Because what? What's happening on his face?
His face is reflecting his emotional response to the music.
Is it ecstasy or is it torture at times?
For him, it was both.
Yeah. And what appealed to you as we listened to his playing from another recording? What pulled you, Seymour Bernstein, to him?
His sense of interpretation.
Yeah.
How he actually responds to music. And the response, as played through the piano, comes out in the exact dynamic and the exact rhythmic formulation. Taking time here, moving there, etc.
Seymour Bernstein, you return to the stage at the end of the film. Ethan Hawke has asked you to perform for some fellow actors, his theater company, but also many of your students are there. It's in the Steinway studio.
In the rotunda of Steinway. It no longer exists, you know. Steinway moved out.
Right. Were you afraid?
Was I afraid? That's putting it mildly. I thought I was going to die. After all, after 37 years, it was quite something difficult to reunite as a performer in front of all of those people. And a movie was being made of it. You can just imagine. So I came into the hall, and I saw all these illustrious actors and actresses, and there were lights and cameras. I thought I was going to die, really. I mean, I thought, I can't survive this. Well, Ethan came over to me, gave me a big hug. And do you know what happened?
What?
A deathly calm came over me.
Huh.
And I remained that way throughout the recital. I did pretty well, I have to tell you the truth. And as many days later, I was contemplating, well, now how could I be so terrified at one moment and calm the next? And you know what I came up with?
What's that?
When you do something for someone else, it temporarily distracts you from your own vulnerability. And so I was going to do this for Ethan. There would be no way that I was going to let him down.
you know, Seymour Bernstein, I am thrown back. It's many years ago, and I'm in Ben Arrigo's studio taking lessons on Long Island. And you know what? Because of you, I bet I'm not the only one who's going to start playing again.
Seymour. Oh, this is great.
Seymour Bernstein, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
In the film, Seymour says music is like God. It's intangible, and he adds with a wink, but we have proof there is music. Here he performs Bach, Here and Now.
And today, the California State Senate is expected to vote on a $1.1 billion emergency water bill that was introduced last week by Governor Jerry Brown. It's an attempt to help Californians deal with the drought, which is now entering its fourth year. On the day he introduced the bill, Governor Brown warned residents to prepare for sacrifices.
This is a struggle, and it's going to be something we're going to have to live with for how long, we're not sure. We're going to have to find the recycling, the storage, the efficiencies. And there's more to do. The Water Board just issued some orders yesterday. There'll be more orders to come. So it's not a partisan problem. The drought is a real problem, a hydrological challenge. We're going to meet it the best way we can by pulling together.
Katie Orr is a state government reporter for Capital Public Radio. She's with us from Sacramento to talk about this. Katie, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us what this bill would do exactly.
Yeah, it's about a $1.1 billion package, and it would do a couple things. We should note that only about $27 million of this dollars of this money is actually new. The rest of it has already been approved in terms of bonds for the state, so most of the money already exists. What this does is try to speed up the application of that money. There's some emergency funds that will go out fairly soon to help bring water to some communities that, for whatever reason, don't have fresh drinking water or don't have a stable supply of that drinking water. Over half of the money is actually for flood control projects.
Well, explain that, because people may be surprised to hear that. Why is so much in a drought bill related to flood control?
Right. Well, Governor Jerry Brown has said he's a big fan of the phrase boom and bust. He uses it a lot when he's talking about California's economy, and he used it talking about the drought, because he says typically when places go through extended periods of drought, then they'll get a lot of rain afterwards. And so we need to have, he says, the flood control projects in place to deal with the uncertainty of the climate, and so that if we do have some rain, we are prepared for it.
But if this drought is so historic, as we know that it is, and we've talked a lot on this program about it, why isn't more money and why isn't more new money being spent by the state to deal with the drought and the effects of it?
Well, the lawmakers here are fond of saying, and I think it's true, they can't make it rain. You know, what they can do is build reservoirs so that when it does rain, we have a place to capture it. They can build pipelines. Governor Jerry Brown is proposing a very controversial pipeline that would help get more water down south to LA. They can do things like that, but they can't actually make it rain. And so what they are trying to do is, as I mentioned before, kind of speed up the process, because when bonds get passed, they can take years to actually be put into action, because you have to go through the whole process of seeing where the projects are going to be and actually getting them built and things like that. So this is trying to streamline that. But in situations like this, when you're dealing with nature, there's not a whole lot that the politicians can really do.
Well, where are we right now on the drought? I see in the LA Times that in some ways, California is actually better off than it was last year. Shasta Lake, which is the largest reservoir in California, 58% full right now, compared with 45% full a year ago. On the other hand, we see a story just today about ski resorts in California having to close early because they don't have enough snow.
Yeah, I think people were optimistic because we got a good period of rain and snow in December. And so people were thinking, oh, we're started off to a good winter. Things are going to be okay. And that might have contributed to some of the reservoirs being more full this year than they were previously. However, that was it. We didn't really get any storms to follow up on that. There just really has not been any snow. And unfortunately, people's conservation efforts have kind of slacked off a little bit.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's because it's gone so long. Last year, Governor Jerry Brown called for a 20% voluntary 20% conservation rate for everyone in California. And at first, people, you know, they were amped up. They were doing it. It was summer. They were holding back. And then, you know, time goes by and people kind of, it's like anything, you know, you get comfortable with it. You turn on the tap, your water's still coming out. So, you know, maybe there's not the drought we've said. Southern California has gotten a few more rainstorms, although it's really the snowpack in the Sierra that is something that we really need to supply water for the state. So the rain in Southern California might be nice, but it doesn't necessarily address the drought.
And this is not the first bill from the governor to address the drought. Should we expect another one if this bill passes, which it's expected to?
Yeah, I think what we would expect next is mandatory conservation. During his news conference, which you played a clip from, the governor was talking about the State Water Resources Control Board, which has so far been the one in charge of implementing the different conservation measures that we have had. And those, though, have all been, you know, sort of voluntary. And now he is saying he understands that they are trying to take a measured approach, but it might be time for him to go urge them to take a little bit more drastic action.
All right. We'll be watching what he does. Katie Orr, state government reporter for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.